Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
This is America Trends, and I'm Larry Rifkin, and he, with me, is John Krofcik.
Yeah.
Hello, John.
How are you doing today?
I am fine. And you?
I'm doing good.
Well, we're here during a really difficult time, and of course, that's what we're going to be talking about today.
We're trapped in the studio.
Well, in the studio, 6 feet apart, my mask by my side, my gloves are on, disinfectant wipes are right here as part of our practice, and we are practicing social distancing a la podcast.
Yeah, that's right.
We're trying to do our best. We really are. And we hope that you're doing well during this period. We've tried to give you some great content that you can listen to. And, John, we've had some great guests lately. We really have. And I don't know if we've ever
had incredible guests.
What's that?
You've had some incredible guests.
Yeah, they have been great. And this one is so important. We live, as you know, we've told you a number of times, just up the road from Yale University. And we don't often...
Does that make us smarter?
I think we're outside of that range, John.
Okay.
I think you have to be within 10 miles.
Darn.
Yeah, we're about 12, so we just missed it. But maybe we get a little of the after breeze, you know, maybe. But there's a new Yale Institute for Global Health. The director, Saad Omer, is with us today on America Trends. Now, I want to put this in context. We had this discussion with him right at the onset of the coronavirus situation. Now, having said that, we really didn't want to get necessarily into the weeds about this particular epidemic coming, a pandemic. We didn't really necessarily want to get into that. But what we wanted to talk about was this superhighway of viruses.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to talk about it. I mean, we've had Ebola, SARS. I mean, how many have we had? It seems like about every 3 or 4 years there's some big... It's not an epidemic, but it's some big virus or something that's coming our way.
So. Oh, absolutely, John. And these viruses and this bacteria, I mean, it travels so quickly. That's the whole point of this conversation. I mean, how do we as a world society, forget the United States, Canada, Iran. I mean, we're all in this together. I mean, if humanity was ever together, bound by certain determinants, it's things like this. And I don't really like, and my wife continues to remind me, why do we hear about America's trying to do this or Britain's trying to do that? Why aren't we working together?
Yes.
Because we are so interconnected, travel, communication, and it's not going to change. I don't care what people say. Once we get a vaccine or some kind of curative, we're going to be back to interconnecting because our supply chains are all interconnected around the world.
I think we are interconnecting. I think the politics, let's face it, everything is politics. So I think when you hear America or you hear Canada's doing this, you know, they're playing politics with their nation to make them sound better. But I think behind the scenes, you know, the scientists and all know that they have to work with other people around the world, and I'm sure they do.
Yeah, I think there's more collaboration on the scientific front than we know about. Let's hope so.
Some of that stuff you hear with a grain of salt.
All right. Well, a grain of salt. Are you giving that as a cure now for this, John?
Except if you have high blood pressure.
Oh, okay. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for that. But over the past 4 decades, John, I mean, the economy has been centered around these big cities like New York, Tokyo, Beijing, whatever, mass travel, supply chains that wrap around the globe several times. I mean, this really is where we are as a world, and that's not going to change. So the question is, how are we going to get better at predicting how this is all coming about, and what are we going to do to buttress our public health systems around the world to have special alerts? I've got to tell you, I saw a story on 60 Minutes. I don't know if you saw it, but it was pretty remarkable. There's a group out of Canada, and they do a lot of consulting with countries and companies around the world to let them know what they're seeing in terms of hotspots for things like coronavirus. So the minute they saw what was going on in Wuhan, they were able, through a collection of different academicians, John, people from all kinds of disciplines using the spiffiest technology. And they could see, just from the cell phone activity in Wuhan and the travel logistics out of that area, where this was going. And on New Year's Eve, John, they put out an alert to all of their clients saying, watch out. Here's where it's moving. They could see it, and they showed you the dots around the world where this was traveling to. And that's really what we're talking about. It is a super highway of a lot of good things, but also a lot of bad things, too.
Well, but I think what we got to come down to is a better way to respond to these things once they come in, to isolate them before they get to where this one got. Because, I mean, that's really when we got big problems, people dying.
Yeah, and are we going to get better at that? I mean, I know we've got these political disputes about the World Health Organization, and we've either got to strengthen that organization, we've got to give it new leadership, whatever it may be, because we need something like it. If it's not who? Oh, that's a great question. Well, let's break it all down today again with the director of the new Yale Institute for Global Health, and we'll talk about how these diseases are more consistent, more constant, as John said, and in fact, more virulent these days, seemingly. And we've got to find out how we can deal with the next one, because there will be a next one.
With me on the line is Saad Omer, and he is the head of the new Yale Institute for Global Health. And I think, Professor Omer, I know everyone has been so worried over the last few months about the spread of the coronavirus. Obviously, these worldwide situations are reason enough for an organization like Yale to set up this multidisciplinary organization, your Institute for Global Health, reminding us of the interconnectedness of the planet as it relates to health concerns. Tell us what your institute is really about.
Yeah, addressing emerging issues like this is one of the things we do. Our institute is about, it starts with an appreciation that, with a set of values, they say that all lives are created equal and inequities in health outcomes are unacceptable. And more so, populations and countries and regions have shown that they can exceed their health outcomes as would be predicted by their economic status. So based on that, Yale created this interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary, cutting across different schools, et cetera, this entity called the Yale Institute for Global Health, that could leverage the various assets that Yale possesses in terms of intellectual assets in service of global health problems. Our center of gravity is the closest to the School of Nursing, Medicine, and Public Health, across these three schools, but we have a university-wide focus and mission.
Over the past four decades, we have developed economies around the world which center on these mega cities and mass travel and supply chains that wrap around the world. What does this mean in terms of the spread of disease from one remote place to another?
Well, we are much more connected than before, and not only connected in terms of travel, but also in terms of our supply chains, as you indicated, in terms of transfer of information, in terms of generation of knowledge and how collaborations in the intellectual space happen. So yes, there is a lot of connectivity. And so the obvious thing is, yes, with more travel, et cetera, you have a likelihood of quick spread of diseases. But the advantage is that, for example, I alluded to the intellectual space, the fact that we have more travel and collaboration between entities mean that when these outbreaks occur, we have a shorter loop in terms of generating knowledge that could help address these kinds of emerging pathogens, et cetera. For example, in this case, the genome of the virus was shared publicly and globally very quickly by the Chinese scientists. They posted it into these places in terms of the raw data. It was synthesized and combined with the other information by folks here in the U.S., et cetera, and was available very quickly for other scientists to come up with targets for vaccination and therapeutics in a record time that we haven't seen before. So there are all of these different sides of this connectivity that we have seen in the recent years.
Do you share the concern that the fact that this emanates from a rather closed society and that there might have been attempts to not admit to the nature and the extent and the difficulty of that we have with this problem, that is one of those issues? And we have many societies today that are less than fully democratic and more autocratic in terms of their flow of information and the like.
Being a democratic society has advantages, and it's a good thing. It's a right thing for a society to organize around in its own right. But there are potential, people think about these kinds of implications in public health emergencies like this one that we are facing. I will, hold my judgment there that there should be accountability. There should be a sort of a detailed look at what happened and how the information was shared. But I will say that what we know is there, from sometime in January, there has been, at least according to the World Health Organization, there has been substantial sharing of data and information and all sorts of stuff coming out of China. And even before that, until the New York Times report came out, or sort of some of the things that investigative journalists brought to the surface, it seemed that there was information flow coming out of China. But again, that part, who knew when, and these are large bureaucracies and large countries, and where, if any delay happened, where it happened is an important question. But at this point, it's not entirely clear to me what are the implications of some of that reporting is. But it should be looked at. We do know, but one thing we can say for certainty is the fact that this kind of sharing of information is way, way, way better than what happened in SARS. Is it still at a level that we would require as a connected global community? That remains to be seen, at least in the early stages.
Now, that was in 2002, the SARS outbreak. We've had so many different things that have come across our screens. And, of course, our screens now are large and small. As you say, we have information superhighway flow. But we've had swine flu, Zika, SARS, Ebola, the coronavirus. And some are comparing what we have seen to past conflagrations that we've had, like the Spanish flu or Black Death. Are these analogies useful or accurate, or has the modern imagination, with all of the ways that we have fictionalized some of these issues, have we kind of overrun the need for concern, given the sophistication and the technology we have to deal with it?
Well, I suppose large outbreaks and even pandemics have been with us for a while as a global community. But it does, there have been, the outbreaks of international concern in recent years, even since the early 2000s. For example, SARS, the so-called swine flu, which was the pandemic flu of 2009 and 2010. Ebola, it didn't come here in vast numbers, but it was an emergency of international concern and remains an overall concern as a pathogen. You know, MERS was a concern, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome virus, and so on and so forth. So yes, we do see these things with some frequency, and we are, and I think a lot of concern is well-founded as long as it leads to action rather than sort of fear-induced paralysis. We should know and we should remember as a population, we have some self-efficacy. It's not that we are helpless witnesses in this slow-moving drama unfolding. We as a country, as communities, et cetera, have even now tools that can be helpful. They're not perfect in the sense that, for example, a vaccine will take some time to not just develop but evaluate, et cetera, and come to a level of production that is helpful for mass vaccination. So we don't have all the tools we should have because of various reasons, but we do have a lot of tools that can be helpful.
Now, the CDC is spending what some would consider a mere $500 million a year on emerging diseases. Is that enough?
Actually, no. It's, you know, the numbers are a little bit fuzzy in the sense that a lot of other appropriations can help preparations like this. But no, not only that. So here's the way I'd like to look at these issues. So we've had this boom and bust cycle of funding in this country of the public health infrastructure, and it's a little bit of a common perception that it's only the CDC that leads the response, and that's our sort of only or even the main line of defense. In fact, the reason why we have a really good public health system is grounded in, you know, it's for lack of a better term, in our sort of the constitutional makeup of this country. And here's the reason why. There are a lot of powers, unless someone is coming in, for example, the power of quarantine is with the state and local authorities. Mm-hmm. Federal quarantine power is limited to someone coming into the country, but a lot of other stuff, once they're here, you know, anyone, so it's usually Americans themselves coming back with an infection, et cetera. So the communities have that power. And so similarly, a lot of public health is local. And with that, we have, the premier public health agency in the world in the form of CDC. Combining those two results in a really robust system. And people have looked at it, compared us to Europe and other parts of the world. Nothing against Europe. They do a lot of things well in healthcare. But in terms of a public health infrastructure, we have a pretty robust public health infrastructure. And so since a lot of it depends on states, and the way it works is that if you have a central, competent, technologically advanced technical agency, you then the states and the health, the state and local health departments request help from such an entity when needed, so they don't have to parachute into a community and say, mm-hmm. look, you know, we are here with all the fancy stuff. You know, so and then sort of look up on Google Maps where something is happening. They already have a local understanding and knowledge of the region within the teams they form. So that's essential. That's under-recognized. On the other hand, you know, there's a central entity. What has happened is that in this country, in the past, in recent few years, we have starved the overall public health infrastructure of resources. Not just the CDC, it's the overall, and a lot of it used to be federal grants, et cetera, because we are in this together. If there is something that crosses state lines with some ease, is an epidemic, and we have seen that. And so often these resources come from the federal government, and we have stalled that kind of an investment in our state and local health departments, and not just the CDC. So it is to our peril that we underfund public health, and then when we as a country freak out a little bit, then we provide a bolus. It should not be that kind of an approach to policymaking and specifically to funding, because what you do is that if you provide this bolus temporarily, a State Department even CDC, they increase their numbers. And then, you know, when the funding goes away, those numbers of people who they trained in these kinds of things vanish. And so you don't have that muscle memory, as much of a muscle memory as it is needed to counter these kinds of things. If you would have, in a situation where you have a stable, predictable source of resources funding your public health system.
With the patchwork that we have of U.S. government labs, sophisticated medical centers, universities like Yale, how do we know that we're able to coordinate a response in time for many other concerns that we have medically? We see where Houston has the best center for this type of cancer, or New York, or whatever. How do we know that we're really coordinating effectively and on time to deal with something that's spreading across the globe?
So that's a good question. And the first thing is, you know, the system is not perfect. It is better than before. And here's how it works. The way it works is there are standing collaborations between scientists, between various U.S. government agencies like the CDC and the NIH, but in this case, the more relevant one within the NIH, the National Institutes for Health, is the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NAIID, which is the component that deals with outbreaks and infectious diseases more than any other entity within the NIH. And so in this kind of a situation, we have an understanding that, you know, when things break in terms of an outbreak, et cetera, and there's a breaking news in these kinds of situations, we activate collaborations that were existing. And then the international collaborations are so essential in these kinds of situations so that we know, you know, who to talk to in a given region. You cannot predict that it's, for example, it's whether it's going to be in Russia or in China or in Mexico or in New Mexico, for example. And so these standing collaborations help. But in terms of, you know, as these things emerge, usually there is a convening of agencies, either at the Secretary of Health and Human Services level or the White House. But also one of the important convenings happens internally within the CDC. They have a mechanism of emergency operations center kind of a situation. And these kinds of where different parts of the CDC come together and they coordinate with all sorts of other national and international partners, and they start sharing information and making decisions and developing advice, et cetera.
How effective has the quarantine been? I mean, we have read where China has implemented the largest of its type in human history, putting more than 50 million people across 17 cities on lockdown. They're shuttering schools and transit. And here in the United States, whenever we hear that there might be a case or we're testing, we try to put someone in some form of isolation. But I've read about different forms. Maybe you can help us sort this out.
Yeah, so before we start on the main part of the question, I just want to clarify a few terminologies. So there are two versions of individual restrictions that are used in public health to control diseases, specifically contagious or infectious diseases. The first one is isolation. So isolation means that if you have some symptoms, if someone has some symptoms, they are isolated for testing and then for the prevention of spreading infection, et cetera, in the community or other people at their workplace and so on and so forth. So that's isolation. The other one is a related concept of quarantine, where you don't have to have symptoms to be quarantined. For example, that is done based on where you are coming from in terms of travel and some of the other exposure history, but not necessarily disease or symptoms associated with that disease. So far, China has taken sort of mass, unprecedented measures to slow the rise of this outbreak. One of the things that we have seen in the past, like just very recently, that the number of cases are not increasing exponentially in terms of reports from China. It's too early to say that whether it's an artifact of data or because in these kinds of situations, without even any malice, as you can imagine, in a really intensive public health response, there can be data delays, there can be sort of breakdown. People who are collecting data or reporting data can themselves become sick, etc., and so on and so forth. But there are early signs of at least we're not seeing an exponential increase coming out of China. But we'll have to wait and see. In terms of some of the other restrictions, from past epidemics, we do know that travel restrictions, in order to be effective, have to basically shut down the country. And even then, we'll have to slow, it'll only slow the outbreak for a few weeks. So travel restrictions have a lot less supportive evidence than compared to some of the other things like isolation and quarantine. We do know that isolation specifically can be helpful in public health response, meaning if someone has symptoms, they don't monitor it and all of that stuff. Often through self-monitoring facilitated by health workers, but also other reasons as well. Quarantine, depending on how you do it, for example, the cruise ship, one of the cruise ships that was anchored in Japan, et cetera, that was quarantined, wasn't perhaps the wisest decision. If anything, that created this closed entity where the infections could spread very quickly. So with quarantine, it depends on how you do it, as much as the tool itself. And so, for example, some of the quarantine approaches the U.S. has taken recently in response to these outbreaks have been okay in the sense that how they were implemented. But there's a third aspect to it in terms of beyond technical, beyond sort of how it's implemented. Mm-hmm. Is this related to implementation as well, but the aspect is how you safeguard the rights and the welfare of those who you quarantine, whose liberty you restrict for the greater good. Because there will be times, first of all, it should be done based on scientific reasons, not just as a show of doing something. But more importantly, if you do so, make sure that they are provided for, make sure that they have all sorts of sort of amenities, et cetera. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be a quarantine in the Four Seasons, but it should be some basic comforts protected, comforts and rights protected, including rights to employment. And that's what becomes one of those issues where, your liberty is restricted and you're not going back to work. And, especially people who have certain kinds of work, their employment gets threatened. So these kinds of things matter, and they not only matter because they're just the right thing to do, just a decent thing to do that a government or a public health authority should do, but also this ensures that the others who are seeing this kind of thing unfold report their illness. Because if you're on the fence, that may be an incentive of, not going out and getting checks and so on and so forth. If you see that people who are quarantined or who are isolated are not being treated appropriately.
And there are these illnesses like the coronavirus where a lot of people are asymptomatic and yet they test positive. So, they could, under the cover of darkness, just go on and live their lives, and yet it could have an impact on others. You've also said that trust in government is essential in all of this. And yet, we had the president recently say, oh, all of this will subside when the warm weather comes. Yet I've been reading that there are some countries where warm weather abounds right now, and yet they have had the spread of coronavirus. So, I mean, how important is it for us to be able to trust what we are hearing from our government or any government?
So that's a good question. But before I get to that, I want to clarify a few things. We're not certain whether people who are asymptomatic with this virus can spread the virus. So they may shed the virus a little bit, but not. We don't know the epidemiological importance of it. And even sort of shedding, et cetera, is emerging knowledge in this kind of in this specific outbreak. So having said that, there are people who have mild symptoms and they are mobile and they're sort of they're moving around in the community and so on and so forth. And so they could fit into the category that you described, that they could spread the infection. And the fact that if they don't see people getting treated well in a quarantine and isolation kind of a situation, they may not be that willing and eager to comply. Coming back to the main, you know, the specific question, yes, trust in government is extremely important. And so, look, a lot of governments misfire a little bit. One thing that has been reassuring is, and that has been reassuring for those of us who have been plugged into the public health infrastructure and our capability to respond to these outbreaks, we have known this for a while, that the scientific leadership of this country's agencies is very mainstream. They could have, like, the government could have, the administration could have appointed, you know, pretty much anyone they wanted, but they chose to either retain, for example, the director of the NIH and the NAID, the infectious disease arm of NIH. Both of them have been retained from the Obama administration. The Secretary of Health and Human Services has experience, not with outbreaks, but overall with health-related issues. The director of the CDC is very mainstream as a well-respected scientist. And the sub-director-level leadership within the CDC is career people who have been in those positions for a while. The FDA leadership is also mainstream and so on and so forth. So in this kind of situation where information is emerging and it's not certain, we don't have perfect certainty about a few things, but we are becoming more knowledgeable as a global health community, as a public health community, every day. One way to ensure the correct decisions and robust, informed decisions is to close the gap, to reduce the gap between assimilation of information and action. And the way to do that is to empower the agency, technical agency leads, to make those decisions. And so that's what seems to be happening so far. I hope it stays that way. And the president sort of saying things which have some truth to it. By the way, it wasn't unfounded in the sense that previous coronavirus is a family, and this is a novel coronavirus, so viruses such as SARS and others have shown some seasonality. But where he went a little bit beyond data, or actually substantially beyond data, that A, we don't know the magnitude, even for those viruses, that what would be the magnitude of reduction, if any, or whether this reduction will happen due to the change in temperature for this virus. So therefore, in this case, there was some kernel of truth to what he said. I just wish he didn't go beyond data, or the wiser thing is to stick to what they have been doing overall, is to let the technical heads lead the response.
I'm wondering globally, what kind of action should we be taking as it relates to animal to human transmission? Wet markets, as they are called, really were thought to be the originator of SARS as well as this new coronavirus. Evidently, Johns Hopkins ran a simulation of a hypothetical coronavirus spawned at a Brazilian pig farm, and it was like the current virus, but really lethal. This one doesn't seem to be as lethal per capita as does SARS, but the result was 65 million dead in 18 months based on their simulation. In other words, what kinds of controls should we be putting on as a global community, as we understand the way the transmission goes?
Yeah, so just to clarify, as you alluded to it, that was a simulation based on parameters of a much more lethal disease than this one, and they have come out and said, you know, the results and the of that modeling and simulation exercise should not be directly applied to this, this outbreak, because that was to test the preparedness and who would act how in that kind of a situation. So, but coming back to this in terms of human to animal transmission. So there has been this concept in the past decade or so of one health, that we are all, so we can't have veterinary health or animal health separate from human health all the time. Obviously, there are sort of subdomains, et cetera. And so that helps us be more vigilant, more cautious, and more sort of proactive in preventing some of these kinds of things. They don't work all the time. There's been a lot of work in, for example, bushmeat in West Africa, and even closer to this, larger poultry farms, et cetera, in this country as well. You know, we need to be rational about these kinds of things where we reduce the risk of outbreaks in them and then transmissions to humans and so on and so forth. So on the positive side, there has been progress in terms of our thinking as a global health community of this concept of one health, where we look at the animal side of things, both domestic and wild animal, but also look at it from perspective of prevention of these kinds of things and risk mitigation. In the context of these wet markets, et cetera, I suspect there will be some introspection in China. I know that these kinds of things support local communities and local economies, and they're part of the culture, et cetera. And it's not easy to say that you shut down all wet markets, for example, because, you know, if you are looking at broader health outcomes, if you increase the economic vulnerability of some of the folks in your society who are at the margins, you may increase morbidity and mortality in certain kinds of cases, because we know that poverty and economic shocks themselves are related to poor health outcomes. So it will have to be a mature look, weighing costs and benefits. But I would be surprised if there's no serious, sober look at least substantial risk mitigation. So there are a lot of other steps communities and countries can potentially take that fall short of just eliminating all of these kinds of entities, et cetera. So I, you know, the bottom line is, folks will have a look at it, more likely than not. What the outcome is, that's a little bit uncertain.
We've been talking about so many issues. I want to go back to certain basics. The flu, which we deal with each year, kills about 35,000 Americans. Should we buttress efforts there to take any pressure off of hospitals and ERs? In other words, is there a risk that we become too complacent about it as we look at these newer and more exotic illnesses grabbing the headlines?
Yeah, well, we should be able to do that as a health system, and we should be able to focus on both of these pathogens. And one way of dealing with this emerging threat of the novel coronavirus and the outbreak associated with it is to actually recommend more vociferously and more proactively the flu vaccine and ask people to take that. It's not that the flu vaccine biologically protects against this novel new coronavirus, but because the flu vaccine is a reasonable tool, not a perfect tool, but a reasonable tool to reduce the likelihood of getting influenza and adverse outcomes associated with influenza. And the way it helps with the coronavirus effect is that it decreases the likelihood that you're going to have respiratory symptoms. And then that way you don't clog up the healthcare system when it is not needed. And so you can focus on other things. You can, and the health system can focus on treating patients with this new outbreak where we don't have the vaccine. And so that's how an effort to promote flu vaccine helps the coronavirus effort as well.
Not to delve too deeply into it, but the anti-vax movement overall in America, I don't know if that's being replicated around the world, but certainly very vociferous. You and I both live in Connecticut, and these issues about religious exemptions have really come to the fore. Is there anything about that in terms of herd immunity that you think we should better understand or think about?
So yes, in terms of respiratory illness overall, having a high immunization vaccine coverage would protect all of us, and so we would be protected against respiratory symptoms due to influenza, for example. So that's, you know, having herd immunity and having higher levels of community immunity are helpful. But even more broadly speaking, the end game for the novel coronavirus outbreak is actually a vaccine. And so having a vaccine and making it available and accessible to a broad swath of our population is how we will eventually control it in a sustainable manner. If at that time there is opposition to this vaccine, it would be incredibly unfortunate because this new virus seems to be pretty concerning for at least part of the population, particularly the elderly. The mortality rate is better, seems to be better outside China a little bit, but still there is a substantial differential impact on the elderly. So it would be incredibly unfortunate if pushback against a new vaccine results in suboptimal coverage.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at bloomshapiro.com.
I know that we're a lot healthier today, obviously, and can ward off many calamities. We've got better, safer food, better ventilation, better water and sewer systems. At the same time, we're much more specialized today, and we all are reliant upon food and medicines coming from elsewhere. And not like many in the past where they live these independent, simple lives. And, of course, we're told now that a lot of our medicines are coming from one source, that being China, the source of the coronavirus. How dangerous is it for us to be too over-reliant on any one region or country, given this superhighway of viruses that can spread?
So there are two ways of looking at it. One is that we sort of create a deeper trench and make sure that we have most of the stuff produced in our country, et cetera, and so on and so forth. But there's a reason why we have distributed supply chains. There is a reason why we have raw materials and production coming from elsewhere. Because in a free market system, entities have figured out that that's the more optimized way. Obviously, there's an argument to be made that at least some of it, some supply chains should be protected. But as an overall, changing that system would be incredibly cumbersome, as I understand. And there's another way of saying that is that rather than building a deeper trench, we build more bridges so that we are in this together, so that we, for the next outbreak, we have a more collaborative system. And we all recognize that everyone has a stake in each other's welfare and well-being and sustaining each other's supply chains. And so in that, we make sure that there is substantial investment from all countries, and there is substantial collaboration in terms of public health, in terms of biomedicine, and in terms of addressing and, more importantly, preempting the outbreaks. So either we go all isolationist, which has its huge disadvantages, or since we are literally in this together, we make sure that we take advantage of this interdependability and build a more resilient system so that if there is, if the system is squeezed mm-hmm. at one end, there's more resilience in other parts.
Understood. You, as the director of the new Yale Institute for Global Health, as you look at the interconnectedness that we have experienced in the world as it relates to the latest outbreak, how have we as a world been handling this in terms of the sharing of information, the ways that we've been trying to work together to make certain that we all understand the implications, and whoever has learned first then informs the next as they go about their business trying to step up public health approaches to this? How do you think we're doing?
Yeah, so I think we are doing as a global community certainly better than we did during the SARS outbreak. It remains to be seen that it's good enough. So there are things that happened that were unthinkable when SARS happened, the quick sharing of data, the collaboration, the open science, and so on and so forth. But sometimes, even if you do better, the challenges sometimes become bigger. And so I think there is progress, there is cause for optimism, but there is also cause for sober reflection after this outbreak in terms of how we can do this better.
Are we managing the psychological contagion as importantly, I would think, that issue as the physical one? What do you think about it?
No, I think we're doing worse on that front than actual epidemiological front. And here's the reason why. I would suggest that our leaders are candid, open, but reassuring. And you can do all those things at the same time by being realistic about what the threat is and understand that people are not necessarily worried about what's happening now. And it's reasonable to say that the current risk, individual risk, is low. But it is also reasonable to say that people are not being paranoid when they are concerned about what's going to happen next. So acknowledge that, but share the preparedness, share the nuances that it is, for example, so one of the biggest concerns in a flu pandemic is people are concerned about their kids because kids have a higher risk of disease. In this case, fortunately, the kids are spared. And so that's a reassuring there's a reassuring focus of this disease away from kids. But the unfortunate aspect is that it disproportionately affects the elderly. So that's one thing, that reassure at least part of the population, but also increase the self-efficacy of the population. To say that we are not, you know, observers, passive observers to an unfolding crisis. We have the power to do something about it. It may not be perfect, but in a game of probabilities, a reduction in the probability of bad outcomes is very important. So people washing hands decreases the likelihood of them getting sick. People staying at home when they get sick reduces the likelihood of them spreading the outbreak. Getting the flu shot reduces the likelihood of them clogging up the health system and so on and so forth. So I wish we, our leaders up and down the chain, and this is irrespective of the political affiliation, et cetera, would focus on a few key messages to enhance the self-efficacy of the population, to make them feel more empowered. So if people feel more empowered, they feel less helpless and less panic, even in the face of something that they need to address, something that is less than ideal, such as a large outbreak. And remember, we the public health people are increasingly sure that there will be community transmission, meaning there will be population level transmission independent of importations in the U.S. In the next few months at least, but we are not sure, and there is some signs pointing to the reduction in the mortality rates outside China compared to China. So it's okay to be truthful, okay to share things that are reassuring, but also increase the population self-efficacy. And if we don't do that, then we increase the likelihood of some of these mental health concerns, in a sense, at least people feeling a sense of anxiety about the outbreak.
With the advent of some of the antibiotics and antivirals, are we getting too confident, maybe complacent, about fighting infectious disease? I mean, is it possible that our luck is going to run out when we confront one deadly pandemic too many? I think that's on a lot of people's minds as we see this repeated need to up our game and response over time.
That's a good question. I would have said that we were sort of getting a little bit overconfident a few years ago, 5-10 years ago, but increasingly the prospect, at least for bacteria, prospect of antibiotic resistance has humbled us a little bit. And so there is increasing recognition that this is not a solution that we can take it granted. And similarly with antivirals, antivirals have seen a lot of improvement, but there are certain limitations as well. So I think there is, at least in the mainstream public health community, there is recognition that we cannot treat our way out of the risk that is posed by emerging infections. We have to focus on prevention, early surveillance systems, early alert systems, reducing the likelihood of transmission at the source, having resilient public health systems. And I don't know if you know that there have been substantial cuts to our public health infrastructure in the past 5-6 years, and that's really concerning. And then some folks say that, you know, the time to repair the roof is not during a thunderstorm, and it's before that. And so I think we'll have to look at our public health infrastructure to make sure that it remains resilient, but actually to increase its resilience, et cetera.
I want to thank you so much for being with us to help us understand the issues at play around the world and here in the United States. Just an honor to have you, and good luck at the new Yale Institute for Global Health.
My pleasure. Thanks.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.